You have tuned into an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening.
The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contreras with your other host, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson, and from American Carnage Report, Dave Willingham. You are listening to us on KMRE 102.3 Bellingham. We would like to welcome today KAVZ, our new listeners, and give a shout out to Deming at 102.5. Welcome, Deming. We're glad to have you on board. We have a lot to talk about. Washington legislature, hot news today. We are going to talk about the county jail vote that just happened and a bunch of other things. We're going to start off with some quick hits. Just wanted to comment briefly on the news that happened about the Willows Inn, if you hadn't heard about it. The Department of Labor laws, the Department of Labor said the Willows Inn was charged with violating labor laws, underpaying its staff. And there's a whole thing in the cooking field about stage and the honor of working for a top chef. And this is one of the most, if not the most famous restaurant, one of the best rated restaurants in the world.
And it's really disappointing because this is a internationally known high-quality restaurant that really was kind of a feather in Whatcom County's cap. But wage theft is wage theft. This is terrible, and it's an awful thing, and it's rampant in the restaurant industry here. I mean, in continental Europe, there are traditions like, you know, you work for a chef for a certain number of years before you're allowed to get paid and things like that. But we have relatively simple laws in this country about paying people a certain amount for the time they work. And the restaurant industry is particularly bad, but this is across all industries in this country. And it was really kind of heartbreaking for me to see this jewel take itself down by making such terrible, terrible decisions.
And I just want to briefly contrast that for the sake of irony that Seattle's minimum wage law that has recently passed has led to higher pay for restaurant workers without affecting the overall number of jobs in the industry. That's according to a new study from the University of California at Berkeley. Just throwing that out there.
And we're still really early. There's going to be a lot of back and forth on this as the economic change gets worked through the system, because this is a huge change and there's going to be a lot of disruption. I believe, and I hope that that's confirmed, that this is an overall good thing for people in Seattle and for the economy as a whole. But, you know, we're going to have to wait and see.
Well, I understand that there were two studies of this particular phenomenon, one from Berkeley, one from the University of Washington. And between the two, what it appears is that there's some kind of a sweet spot, that if you raise wages too much, it actually does have a deleterious effect on the economy. It could be something that's not economically viable. And it seemed to me like the range is somewhere between 12 and 15, if I remember from these two studies. So there's a sweet spot. And the you know, tragedy for America is that we're not anywhere near the sweet spot in terms of what we pay for those kinds of jobs.
That's a very good point. The classical economics view is a minimum wage at all is a major impediment to hiring. If you can pay people whatever, you'll have more employment. And you know, we're finally kind of getting to the point where people are recognizing that, oh no, if we pay people at a certain level, that sparks the economy and that's good for everybody. And yeah, we're really at the beginning of a big shift in this country, I think.
And I would like to give a shout out to our fabulous Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, who, among many other things, has stood up for minimum wage in Washington State. And we will have our Normal, Bob Fergie Love Fest coming up later in the program. And before we get into the quinoa bowl that we will be digging into tonight, let's have another quick moment to say hey to our federal delegation, our senators, Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, and our congresspeople, Susan Del Benny and Rick Larson, for standing up, particularly in the Senate, but standing up for my health care and your health care as well.
Yeah, and it's very good to see. And as we're going to talk about, you know, the big thing that's happening in our state now is we're working on the budget. And this both proposals to radically change our healthcare system in this country from the House earlier this year and from the Senate this month would be disastrous economically on this state. The state would inherit millions of dollars that they would need to pay to keep what we have. And so we'd probably see pretty drastic reductions.
Right. And not to take away anything from our congressional delegation, because they've made some wonderful statements on this and they've been strong. But this is an issue that is pretty easy to be strong on because the Republican proposal is disastrous by every possible measure. And you know, these various, it's interesting, these various proposals, they've had three of them now from Congressional Budget Office, and each one of them is says that somewhere around 22 to 24 million Americans will lose their medical insurance as a result of that. That's larger, that number is larger than the number that have benefited from Obamacare, which means it's there's going to be a net loss at the end of this thing. And it's been done three times. With whatever methodology. And that means at this point, this is deliberate on the part of the Republican Party because, you know, they have the information that would allow them to make a different choice.
They can't say they didn't read the bill.
That's right. And they are not choosing to make a different choice. They are going down this road. And, you know, this is one of the ones I think is pretty easy. Stand up for the American public, stand up for 24 million Americans and more.
And I am almost positive that Dave Willingham will get into that on his own show on Monday. So I'll give a little plug for American Carnage Report, which really focuses on national and international news, particularly news that you won't hear in mainstream media because they don't have time. So listen to American Carnage Report right here on KMRE on Monday at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. But it's a good segue into what's happening in the state. I think many of us in Washington State, particularly people like me who have relied on Washington Basic Health and Basic Healthcare and Apple Health before we had the ACA, hope that we will rely on it again should the national health care disappear. But that's going to depend on where we are with the state budget. So if you had not heard, as of right now, there was a tentative, Jay Inslee said, agreement in principle. This is Wednesday. They are supposed to report the details on Thursday. And there's a lot to unpack about where we are right now. Who wants to start?
And I'll jump in. It's without getting into too much of it, right now we know that there is some sort of agreement, that there is some sort of framework, but we're not gonna get to know about it until about noon tomorrow is the story right now. And that's incredibly frustrating. In this, it's bad enough that we've been going for months waiting for this. This has been the thing we are waiting for. And now we're so close and they're not going to release it until tomorrow. It's crazy making.
Yeah. I spoke to Senator Kevin Ranker, the 40th District Representative, Democratic Representative, and he is the top Democratic budget writer. I spoke to him earlier this week. And when I spoke to him, I called him in the morning and it sounded like he had just woken up off the floor or something because he had been up till 2 o'clock in the morning. He's been up till 2 o'clock in the morning every week, every day this week, including today, trying to hash this thing through.
I think it was even later. It sounded like it was an all-nighter. And it was early this morning. He posted that it was about time for a nap. But, man, they have put in some long hours.
And I think that the reason that we're not getting the details is because there's a lot of fear about blowing it up. you know, with some, and you know, I know that Senator Ranker was very concerned about making a remark that you know, someone could construe as some excuse to not move forward. I think that there's going to be, and we can get into these issues, but I think there's going to be some very bitter pills for the Democrats to swallow, because I think the Republicans hold the hot hand, because it's important to the Democrats for the government not to shut down July 1st. And while I would not say it's not important to the Republicans, it's certainly leverage that they can use to extract pain from the Democrats.
Every side is going to say that we are shut down because of the other side.
Well, they are, but there is a basic rule, and the basic rule is that the party in power takes the blame. Mm. And, you know, what's going to happen is, no matter what happens, if the government shuts down on July 1st, the person that's going to take top blame for it is Jay Inslee. He's not even involved in the budget.
I know, it's not. Yeah.
But he's not. But he will be, because he sits in the big chair, and he's the one man that we can point to blame for the fact that the parks aren't open on July 4th.
Go ahead.
And I get the fear of not blowing up the plan, because that's very real, because we are at the 11th hour. This is so late that most representatives probably are not going to be able to read the entire thing. The thing that makes me anxious about that is that there are so many tripwires between now and Friday that some small group of people could blow this up. And if they had started this process 2 months ago, like they were supposed to, this wouldn't be a crisis bill. You know, this is becoming an 11th hour, last minute thing. And even bills that go through the normal process, there was earlier this year, and we talked about it, the biometric security bill that our own Jeff Morris supported and things like that had to be edited after the fact because they accidentally made it illegal for Department of Corrections to take people's fingerprints at prisons. And, you know, rushing bills is a terrible way to make policy.
It is. And I would go a little further, and I would say that the one thing, I mean, I don't think they ever will learn it, but the one lesson the Democrats need to learn from this is that they should not push these things into the late hours, because that condition always favors the Republican Party, because when it comes to government, the Republican Party is willing to kill the hostage. Democrats are not willing to kill the hostage. The Democrats have an interest in government. Republicans have an interest in government, perhaps, and at their leisure and their option. And it's a mistake. It's a strategic and tactical error for the Democrats to let these things run out. They should have. And I don't know that they could have, but they should have figured out a way to extract some pain from the Republicans back in the regular session.
Well,
so that
that's the question. When you say don't go into the late hour, like, what's the other option when Republicans are grinding down? And you yourself have used the phrase cut to the bone. Like, we have cut everything we can cut. And I don't know what other options to provide Democratic representatives.
Yeah, I agree. It's a difficult situation. And you know, I mean, it's not a nice analogy, but, you know, when the people that hold the hostage don't care whether the hostage gets shot, it's very hard to negotiate with that kind of a situation. I mean, the Republicans, if we go into a government shutdown, they actually will benefit somewhat politically from that, because, as I said, you know, the party in charge takes the blame, and the person that's going to look inept and like they didn't manage the situation, and when people go out to their state parks on July 4th and they find the gate down, it's Jay Inslee that's going to get the blame for it.
And let's be really clear. When Dave is irate, if I can call you irate, about the timing, the budget cutoff was Friday. That, as of this recording, is 2 days away. And this is not pussyfooting around. People will be laid off on Friday. And the people who get hurt, regardless of which party is in charge, the people who get hurt are, A, the people who work for the state at any level, who expect a paycheck, have to feed their children, and B, the people who depend on all of our state programs, the mental health programs, the transportation, even like you said, the parks, which not as important to me, the 4th of July, but, you know, it's something to consider. What does it mean and how much does it cost, especially for whoever and whatever falls through the cracks during that layoff?
And that's a great point. You know, already state parks are closing at 4 p.m. this Friday, regardless of what happens, because the state does not have time to react to whatever happens in the meantime. So they have said everything's going to stop. You know, if we go over this and we, for the first time, have a partial shutdown, like you said, more than 30,000 people are laid off immediately. You know, we stop having support personnel for law enforcement, like forensics. We stop having community monitoring for formerly incarcerated people. We have a ton of children who aren't going to get food aid. We have families who live in state-supported housing who are going to get an eviction notice. And even for the people who are not going to get laid off, this is going to make their life considerably harder. It's going to be harder to be a cop without that community supervision. It's going to be harder to be a cop without that forensic support.
Right. And this is something that Senator Ranker told me. You know, he wanted to be very clear about this. It's not like the Republicans don't care about this issue. They do care about it. But they know that they can extract pain from the Democrats because the Democrats care a little bit more about this because it's their constituent. It's the people that the Democrats, you know, profess to care about, the people at the low end of the spectrum, you know, mothers, children, low-income families. Those are the people that are going to suffer from immediate shutdown and also state employees. And so if you're interested in government, if you're interested in the, you know, competent, regular function of government, this is, I mean, you're like sweating bullets that this thing gets done before Friday.
And regardless, both parties, I mean, not to be an apologist, but both parties got us to this point. As we said, like maybe there weren't other options. But in the meantime, as Dave sort of alluded to, this came out this early this morning and the details are going to be released Thursday. Are people going to have a chance? Are our legislators going to even have a chance to read what these new bills look like and what may or may not have been slipped in?
Well, I think that there's a very good concept in the legislature of the framework of what is going to have to happen here. And what has happened is there was an agreement in the regular session that they really were going to knuckle down and fund McCleary. And this budget funds McCleary. It is monumental in the fact that it finally, after several years, tries to address the funding of public education in the state of Washington. And there were a couple of trade-offs for that. One is that the rest of the budget was bare bones because there's not been an agreement about revenue. But I think that what's going to happen here is that the Democrats are going to have to accept the Republican plan for revenue for schools.
You're listening to Cascadia News Now with Stephanie Contours. That was Tim Johnson, and Dave Willingham is also here. And we are going to get into a little bit more of the details, some speculation about the details, obviously, on McCleary and, of course, Hearst when we come back right after this.
My name's Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I'll be playing a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists, whether it's alt-country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa. There'll be music and interviews with Americana artists from a lot of countries that may surprise you. So join me every week for an hour-long musical trip across countries and continents on the International Americana Music Show.
International Americana, Fridays at 8 p.m. and Wednesdays at 10 p.m. on KMRE 102.3 FM.
Hey, Bellingham. The Spark Museum wants to electrify your spring break with fun demonstrations and activities to explore sound, electricity, magnetism, and robotics. Spring break hours are 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wednesday through Friday, April 5th, 6th, and 7th, with demonstrations scattered throughout each day. The nonprofit Spark Museum is located at 1312 Bay Street in downtown Bellingham with a mission to get kids excited about science. Visit sparkmuseum.org for more information.
You know, Miles, Muddy, and Mongo are gone from this earth, but remain a presence in the present with Hacksaw Jazz.
Jazz and blues from RadioPhoenix.org. This is Full Moon Hacksaw.
Yes, chords and scales, but also lyrics and melody. It's Hacksaw Jazz with you Sundays at 8 and Wednesdays at 9 p.m. on KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham, Washington.
Jazz and blues, Full Moon Hacksaw.
Cascadia News Now, and you're listening to us on KMRE and KAVZ. We're talking about the last-minute handshake agreement that has left us teetering on the edge, closer, as many news sources have said, closer than we've ever been in Washington State to a government shutdown. And Tim Johnson, you were just getting into McCleary, so let's unpack that yet again. This is basic funding, public education, K-12 education. It could leave hundreds of school districts in limbo. And there's been, as Dave brought up at the beginning of the legislative session, that people had been sent off to research and come up with solutions and started the session, as we look back, with no solution.
Yeah, this has been a very long road. And, you know, to kind of recap, 2014, the state Supreme Court said Washington State was not meeting its fundamental obligation to take care of education in the state. And part of that was based on the fact that so many school districts had to pass levies in order to fund basic things like teacher salaries. And this has been a can that's been kicked around for a long time, but this was the year. This is the year they were going to do it. And it's not gone splendidly, frankly. Senate Republicans came up initially with a fundamentally unserious set of principles that they wanted to follow, and finally came up with a property tax hike that isn't. And House Democrats, as they do, introduced a bunch of new potential revenue sources for the state, and now they have some sort of agreement on what they're going to do with it, and I guess we won't get to see it soon. I have a feeling it's going to be property taxes.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. And you know, what the issue there is that, you know, just to trace this back, you know, the Republicans spent about half of the regular legislative session saying that we didn't need any new revenues to meet this $7 billion hole, that we could get this, fill this $7 billion hole with cuts. And, you know, back in 2009, the state of Washington was in a bad situation, as a lot of people, in a recession, and they cut $5 billion out of the budget at that point. And so the idea that there was another $7 billion to be cut, that was a foolish thing. And I have to say the Republicans abandoned that about halfway in, and they did come up with this idea. And what I would say is that what the proposal is that it essentially sunsets property tax levy, local property tax levies, in preference to a statewide levy, but it does so without any consideration of what property values are. So what will happen if this is adopted is that people that live in high property value areas, like in Puget Sound, their property taxes are going to go up. And if you live out in red area, you know, Spokane, Central Washington, those areas of where property values are a little lower, you might actually see a break. And this is a very poisonous pill for Democrats, because it means that all of the Democrats' districts, their property taxes go up. And it's a great thing for the Republicans, because it means that in a lot of districts in Central Washington, their property taxes are going to go down. However, there was not enough leverage from the Democrats in order to push for new revenues from new sources. So this is simply a reorganization of property tax in the state of Washington that will, you know, hit places like Bellingham, hit places like the San Juan Islands. It'll hit them pretty hard. But, you know, if you live out in, I don't know, Quincy or something, it might actually be good for you.
Well, it was fascinating to me, because I depict the conservative viewpoint as being anti-property tax. And as you broke down, it sure is anti-property tax for some people, but it was presented as a very we're going to do this property tax thing to solve all the problems, which I thought was sort of a clash in messaging for people who are not necessarily breaking this down. So I thought that was an interesting tactic, especially in another year where everything is political posturing. But I have to say, you know, I live in Bellingham. I think I'm in the area that's going to get taxed more. I think we all are. But is there something to be said for cutting a break for some of our poorer areas of the state?
Well, you know, there's always something to be said for cutting a break. You know, and you're right. I mean, this is a political party that has carried its fortunes on the back of Tim Iman for years and his concepts of taxes. You know, I think. You know, from those of us who are kind of technocratic about and our approaches about things, there are a lot of revenue sources that can actually be taxed in the state of Washington and that aren't taxed through a sales tax, a retail sales tax, or a property tax. And those options are just simply off the table. And so one of the things that the Democrats were looking at was a high capital gains tax, a tax on profits of extraordinary, you know,
above
size.
A certain level, yeah.
Of extraordinary size. And that's something that's not taxed in the state of Washington. So that's a revenue stream that you might be able to put a tax on that would have no effect on your average person in the street. It would not raise their property taxes. It would not increase the cost of their groceries. Those things were just simply not acceptable to, you know, the Republican caucus in Olympia.
Yeah, and really, if you want to help people in the poorest areas of the state, we have to restructure how the state generates revenue. We are tremendously regressive, and people who are in poorer areas are paying a larger percentage of their income in taxes than people who are wealthy in this state.
Right. And I don't want to, you know, I'll put a happy face on it, which is that part of the idea of McCleary was that in these areas of low property taxes, they also had trouble passing levies, too. So one of the things that was happening in the poorer areas of Washington was they, you know, the schools were suffering. And this is the heart of McCleary. It's not that schools aren't being funded in the state of Washington. It's simply that the state has a duty to fund schools, and it was sloughing its duty off on local taxing authorities in order to get these
things
done.
Which depends on votes and depends
right.
on the nature of the constitution of the area
right.
and whether or not they tend to support levies or not.
But I would say that Bellingham kind of gets gut punched in this because Bellingham always supports its schools. It always passes levies. It has excellent schools. And now its property taxes are going to go up in order to make sure that the people in these places that will never pass a property tax, their schools are good too.
So I don't think this is part of the constitution of our state, but it makes me wonder when we focused so hard and so desperately on McCleary, what does that mean for higher education?
Speaking to Senator Ranker, he said that higher education is just going to get punched hard.
Oof.
in this budget, and everything gets punched hard. Women's health gets punched hard. Children's health, environmental, shoreline rules. Everything really got scissored hard in order to make this happen to meet the requirements of McCleary. So I think we can be happy that this McCleary issue is finally being addressed by like adults. We can be happy about that. But the rest of the state is getting punched because of this.
And when you say getting punched, let's just break that down right before the top of the hour. Is that going to look like school closures for higher education? Is it going to look like higher tuition? Is it going to look like letting go of professors?
Well, how I would characterize it is there are known things that we would like to do as a society in higher education. There are goals that we have. We know that there are things we'd like to do, and I would say that we're going to do none of those things. And so it's sort of a lifeboat approach to government, which is the things that we're doing, we may continue to do, but the things that we know need to be done, we're not going to approach those things.
Yeah, and you know, specifically to higher education, it's probably going to look like it did, you know, shortly after the recession, where we had, you know, tuition increases, we had expansion plans delayed. It's not probably going to be anything closure as much as some people would like to. So, you know, it's going to be bad, not catastrophic.
And as you said, Tim, it's not just higher ed. I mean, it's important to us because we have a university and community colleges here. But we talked about healthcare and bringing the conversation full circle to where we started. If our national healthcare is on the line, we may need to depend on state healthcare and basic health a lot more than we heretofore had. So we'll be looking for those details, but I'm waiting with bated breath. And we'll stop for a moment, and I'll let you know that you are listening to Cascadia News Now with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and Stephanie Contouris on KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham and KAVZ 102.5 in Deming. Before we leave the impending doom of the legislative agreement, the budget agreement, let's just touch base. I know we're speculating, but let's touch base on Hearst. And I heard some hints from legislators that the Hearst stuff just got thrown under the bus entirely.
Yeah, I don't know if that there are two budgets happening right now. There's the operational budget of the state of Washington, and there's their capital budget. And the capital budget is something I think that will be approved later on, but it's completely dependent upon this action that needs to happen this week. And the Republicans have made it very clear that they're not going to support a capital budget. This is a different thing than we're talking about now, but they won't support a capital budget unless there's a fix for Hearst. And the only fix that they will accept on Hearst is simply that language is drafted that says that rural wells are not an issue. I mean, in other words, the issue of rural wells are not an issue because the legislature is going to declare that it's not an issue.
And yet it is.
Yeah, and that is, I think, kind of the catastrophe. We did see just today introduced in the House a new fix for the Hearst decision that would be a temporary hold until, I believe, December 2018. It's got one of the best titles I've ever seen on a bill. It's at least 30 words long, and it's so long it gets cut off on the legislature's website. So I haven't made it all the way through, and I'm not going to read it. But
thank you.
It's it looks like the House Dems are at least getting ready for a stopgap for a little while.
Right. And just to maybe recap this, and maybe this will explain it a little more fully, but back, you know, in November, October, the Washington State Legislature said there used to be under the Department of Ecology rules an exemption for rural wells, that they weren't subject to the same sorts of water availability study and restriction and requirement as other things. And the Supreme Court basically said, no, exempt wells are no longer exempt. They have to be part of a county's overall water budget, their overall water planning. And so what happened was, since there wasn't a central authority for this, a lot of counties, including Whatcom County, put down a moratorium on building until this could be resolved. So basically what the Republican Party would like to see happen is basically say that, you know, that exempt wells are in fact exempt and we'll just continue to do business as we have. And the problem with that, I think on the larger side, is that there are people that actually have water rights that are impeded by aquifer, you know, going down and water quality concerns, water quantity concerns. People actually have senior water rights that this bill ignores. And, you know, I'll just put it out there that the tribes are one of them.
Yep.
And so the tribes, this thing would just steamroller any senior water right claim essentially and make it subordinate to these rural well claims.
And it's not as severe here in Whatcom County, but there are watersheds in this state where these permit exempt wells are drawing a tremendous amount of water out of, you know, the normal flow. So this is a really big deal statewide, and I still am distantly hopeful that we're going to get an actual resolution to this.
Yeah, and I think that they are going to resolve it. My preference would be that you know, because I like to live in an adult world, that we would recognize that there is a problem and that it needs some resources applied to it, and that if they're going to do a fix, that they put some money behind it too. And they just don't say, they just don't make a declaration that a problem that is a problem and everybody knows it's a problem. They just don't make a declaration that it's not a problem and then move on from that. What you'll get from that, I believe, I predict, is you would get just a flash of well digging going on everywhere as everybody's digging their well as fast as they can because they know that the gate's going to close down. And then the Supreme Court will probably come back in and say, you know what, these, once again, we're going to assert what we said in the first place, which is that these have to be within the whole framework of water law in the state of Washington and Western water law, and that you this thing is not going to fly. And so, you know, it's going to open the gate so thousands of people come through, and then you're going to have thousands of more people to deal with because you didn't put money in it.
And our watershed's depleted that much faster.
Yes.
And then God only knows the crisis that will come after that. So regardless of what happens with Hearst on the state legislative level, and we can keep our fingers crossed, our Whatcom County government is going to have to deal with it one way or another. And that's an interesting question, particularly right now, because we are in the primary, and our primary election is August 1st. This is really important. I know some candidates are doorbelling, and it's not that people don't know that there are candidates. They don't know that there's a primary. And wherever you are, whatever your perspective is, this is the time that you, and we can't stress it enough, that you've got to get to know your candidates, and you've got to understand that it is your water, it is your land, it is your education, all of these issues that you can have a lot of influence over, especially in the primary. That being said, let's look at the candidates, and we will be posting some interviews, and we will have in future shows, we're going to interview some of the contested races. And Tim Johnson, you've already started that at the Cascadia Weekly. And how's that going?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I guess the way I would the interesting thing about a primary is, usually you get two people that are sort of ideologically similar and then somebody that's out of that. You know, so you get maybe two conservatives running in a race, and then you have one liberal, or two liberals and one conservative. And what tends to happen is those people with similar views, they contest against one another, and they knock each other out. And so in a top two, you know, we're a top two kind of society, and what's going to happen is I think probably it's predictable what's going to happen is the similar candidates are going to knock each other out, and then there's going to be a race in the general between a conservative and a liberal candidate in all of those districts. Doesn't have to be, but it's a good prediction.
No, I think that's true, especially in the the brand new Foothills district. I think this is really going to come down to who can wrap their minds around it first, because it is. You know, as I say, and I continue to be amazed by this district, because it is so odd based on, you know, everywhere I've ever lived, there has not been a district quite like that.
And in what way?
In that there's no real center of gravity to it. It includes a couple of small towns, but mostly rural, low density, and with some pretty varied interest and lifestyle in there. So it's going to be hard to turn people out. It's going to be hard to get your message out there. The media landscape is very limited when you get outside of Bellingham, and so it's going to be really a different type of campaign to win out there.
I compare it a little bit to Susan Dilbeny's congressional district 1, because that's an inland district, and it's huge. There's no center of gravity to it, and it's kind of swingy, because there are liberals and conservatives, and this district has parts of South Bellingham in it, and it's got the foothills, and it's got Glacier, and it's you're right, it's geographically huge, and there's no center of gravity to it.
But what I was going to say is, let's break down again that top two, because it is pretty unique in our state that it's not like most primaries where you pick the best of this party and you pick the best of that party, that it could conceivably be two conservatives in the foothills, which is considered, or they tried to structure it as a conservative. I mean, it's fascinating that Rebecca Boonstra ran, and who knows how successful she'll be. But it is, to me, it's odd and unfortunate that we don't have people deciding who's the best to represent their ideology, that you could have two conservatives. And the same thing for the city race with Rebecca, I'm sorry, I just blanked. Gene Layton and Roxanne Murphy and Eric Bostrom, that it could very well be that the two more liberal people are in the general. And it's unfortunate that that's the way that we're structured, but I think it makes it even more important that we educate ourselves and vote.
It is, and what you say is absolutely true. It doesn't have to be that way. And in fact, you know, I don't know, you know, the Foothills District, it may actually be that there are, in fact, two conservatives. But, you know, what generally happens is in a three-way race, two people pull really strongly from one another. And that's just the... That's the society in which we live, and it's the idea that there's a message out there that is appealing to, you know, let's say 45% of the public one direction, and there's a message that is appealing to 45% of the public in a different direction, and the 45% is split two ways.
So taking a look at some of the behind-the-scenes news, or the behind-the-scenes dirty laundry of the news this week, normally, it seems to me that a lot of primaries are pretty straightforward, and maybe in the public eye, things seem to be straightforward, but heating up on social media, there's been a couple of kerfuffles this week, and I just want to touch on them. The first one is our other station, our other LPFM in Bellingham, KZAX. They had a show that interviewed Eric Bostrom, and there was concern that they were giving him a platform. He has been known to be pretty extreme in his views, and one of the people who waves very religious signs that pretty much condemn LGBT and queer issues, and has been outspoken anti-immigrant. And so the question arose, should a station, whether it's a community station like this one or whether it's a mainstream station, should that person have a platform?
Well, the person has a platform. You know, they're running for office, and they get, you know, there are things that come with that. And I think that there is an obligation if you have a news thing, a paper or a station or something, that you let people know who people are. And I think one of the ways to do that is you sit down with them and you talk with them about who they are. And I will say it's very hard in this country because a lot of reporters and media organizations have been cowed by incumbents and parties and things to the point where they either blandly repeat what people say or they give little like puff interviews and things like that. But I think it's important to be critical of all of these folks because they're running for office and these offices are important.
Yeah, and you know, I don't really want to comment on what others should do. I know that how I consider this, and as somebody that publishes a newspaper, I've got a circulation, I can amplify a voice quite a bit, and I have to think about that moving forward, whether that voice really ought to be amplified. I mean, in the case of Eric Bostrom, there's the candidate persona that is out there since he announced that he's running. And when you interview him and we talk to him, he is the candidate. And then there is the person that he was before he became a candidate, which is quite a bit different. And so the question becomes, well, do you just interview somebody straight face and then publish what they say when it actually is not actually representative of who they are? And what's the high duty? And I think that if you are, maybe if you're very skillful when as an interviewer, you might be able to get the real person to emerge through the interview. But if you can't, you run the risk of presenting somebody out there that is not who they are, and now you've amplified that. You've actually asserted that a person may be more rational, reasonable, kindly than they actually are, and it's a huge balancing act. I mean, I have to confess that I have had a limited amount of space this week. There were two people that had very interesting urban, municipal, city council opinions that were out there. The other person has some, and I don't think they're necessarily illegitimate. And I would like to say that he's got free speech. He can run for office. It's an open society. I'm just talking about my particular decisions that I make as a publisher. I only had a limited amount of space, and so I just decided to focus on the two people that actually have municipal views.
Well, I think that's totally fair. I think that it's important, though, to remember that, you know, we've just been talking about this state legislature and the budget and all of this mess, and how some people in the state legislature have sabotaged the process for months, and they have brought us to this point where they're going to get some of what they want, and they have wasted thousands of dollars. They have jeopardized lives and, you know, people's livelihoods, and most of them are going to get reelected, and most of them are from places that have very limited media, where there aren't people to really call them to account for what they've done. So when they go home and they sing their song about their version of it, that's what's going to get reported. That's what's going to get heard. And I think, you know, I would like to think that people want to step up and people want to confront that and people want to know what's actually true and what's happening. And I would like to think that if people did that, maybe some of those people would pay some sort of consequence for what they've done.
Well, and I think you're both getting to the deep core of the issue. Does the media have an obligation to present people's viewpoints of anybody who runs? And or do we have the right to choose the people that we think are most viable? And then by what metric do we choose? I mean, if somebody from the Salmon Yoga Party runs again, are we going to interview for somebody from the Salmon Yoga Party? How do each of us make this determination? And Dave and I have been sort of going around and around about this for a week. And our decision is that we have invited Eric Bostrom to come in and interview with us, as we have with everyone in that race, Roxanne Murphy and Gene Layton, and also Todd Donovan and Amy Glasser. So I will touch on that briefly. This has been sort of behind the scenes, that there's been some irate feelings back and forth between the campaigns. And Amy Glasser declared in December of last year. And this is all stemming from a reshuffling, as we were talking about the foothills and the whole new district, because people are not going forward as they normally would, making a decision, am I going to run here, am I going to run there? Todd has two more years, but at the end of those two more years, he's out of a job. And so on one hand, there's the extreme of Todd and Satpal Sidhu trying to figure out who's going to run in which district that they are now in going forward. And on the other hand, here is a brand new, by default, open seat that should be open to everyone. So without getting too much into the dirty laundry, I think that there's been some name-calling and some irate behavior, and I'm going to just put out a plea for people to stick to the issues.
Yeah. You know, this is an interesting one, and I've been watching it and giving it a lot of thought. It's not just those two. There were three people who are currently on county council in the former District 2 that are now reshuffled into this. And so they had a conversation to have among themselves about how they were going to do, whether they were going to even run again or what they were going to do. And Amy has every right to run for office, and I'm glad that people step up. But somebody posted a comment, you know, on Facebook about this, and I thought that it was a really prescient comment, which is that when this kind of thing, I mean, Amy ran under the idea, under the knowledge that she would be running against an incumbent.
I don't know if there was that knowledge because Todd hadn't decided, right?
Well, let me put it this way. There's three people, and probably a pretty good chance. pretty good chance you might be running against an incumbent. And when you run against an incumbent, you are essentially telling voters, and this is not my opinion, I'm just reporting what I read, and I thought it was a very prescient kind of thing. But when you're running in a primary like this, you're asking for that person to be fired. So, I mean, if we can put it into those terms, Amy is asking for Todd to be fired. And she has to make a case that he deserves to be fired. And then, you know, when we get into the general, then she can move around that this other guy that we're talking about, this third person, shouldn't be elected. But you see my point. So that by its very nature adds a level of rancor to the discussion. It makes it just a little contentious because she really has to make the case. She has to make the pitch that the incumbent really doesn't deserve to keep his job.
Well, I very much agree with that. There's few things you can do that are more personal than run for office and ask thousands of people to vote for you one by one in front of groups, all of this stuff. And it's really easy when someone isn't going to be deeply hurt by that. And, you know, when somebody runs against you, regardless of, you know, whether you're an incumbent or not, that is a personal thing. That's a hard thing. But that's what these people have signed up for. And, you know, buckle up, Buttercup. This is what you're doing.
Right. And I hear that logic, but I think where it's faulty that you're asking for somebody to be fired is that this is an unprecedented situation. It's not somebody running against somebody for a district that heretofore existed. I don't think that somebody can lay that deliberateness on her feet, especially because she was out there very clearly for months. And is it incumbent upon those incumbents to have a discussion with somebody who runs before filing week? I don't know. And I don't know if those discussions happen behind closed doors, but I think there's an accusation that she is deliberately by her race calling for somebody to get fired, and I don't see it like that.
Well, how I would see it is I think you're being a little coy about that, about the idea that this is a brand new district and therefore it's absolutely wide open, fresh.
I mean, there's nothing coy about it.
No,
right?
I think it's a little coy in the sense of what the framework of the redistricting was. The redistricting didn't come about as the redistricting really came about as a mechanism to forestall and take the nasty edges off a district only voting scheme that would have really skewed county politics in a particular way. And so this was I think the idea that in moving from three districts to five, that would create a wide open, unheard of district, a brand new district, it's a little naive to think about that, particularly when in that district there are three people who are sitting in office right now that, you know, obviously could run for that race. Some of them, obviously one of them did, and there was some kind of a conversation about who might be the person. I mean, there's Barry Buchanan, there's Sat Paul Sadoo, Todd Donovan, all of them are on the council right now. I think all of them have a desire to continue to serve. I think that if you understood that, you'd have to be pretty naive to think that you could run in that race and you wouldn't be running against an incumbent.
It's not the responsibility of a candidate to decide what the mechanisms and the machinations behind closed doors of how are we going to divvy up these districts like they're pieces of pie that they already get to keep on their plates. And I'm sorry, Tim, but no, not people don't decide to run again. Sometimes people are one-term people, and we are speculating. We don't know what kind of conversations any of them may have had. But my point is, if she declared in December, she could have ended a campaign much easier in December or January, February than at this point when she's been amassing money and fomenting her messaging. And I don't know that it's her responsibility.
Well, I don't think it is her responsibility, and I wasn't trying to say that it was her responsibility. I wasn't trying to make that point at all. I mean, and I said at the outset, and I'll say it again, and I'll maybe even say it a third time, but she has every right to run for public office.
And go ahead.
Well, I think that statement is really important. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there is this sense that, you know, some seat is the incumbent's seat when, in fact, it's a job and no one is entitled to it. And our society would be better off at every level if more people were running for those jobs, if we had a better selection of candidates who are working harder to become better public servants, we would all be better off.
And the discussion we're having, to be completely honest, is an ideological issue that the Democratic Party has faced for decades, that there is this sense of the incumbent machine and we have to support the incumbent machine at all costs. And I'm taking this outside of have people done a good job, obviously, as individuals. But there's that we have to lockstep behind our incumbents versus we are a party of Democrats and we welcome new ideas and we welcome new people and we're a big tent. And I think that that is the Achilles heel of the Democratic Party, at least in Washington State and Whatcom County.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about the fact that an incumbent is entitled to anything. What I'm talking about is the expectation. What I'm talking about is the character of the race and why it has kind of gotten a little edge to it. And the reason it's gotten an edge to it, again, and I think that it was an interesting – Amy is trying to make the case that she deserves the job and Todd does not deserve the job. And that's the case she needs to make to voters. She may make that case, and that may be the outcome, and that's part of our democratic process that we cherish and honor. She may not make the case, but the original question was, why is there a little edge to this race? And I think that that's the nature of the edge.
Right. Well, they both have to make that case
to
us, and we are going to interview them, and you will be hearing their interviews next week, so that will hopefully help you make your own decisions. We just have a couple of minutes left, so let's just briefly touch on the City of Bellingham letter to the county and their subsequent vote. Tim, do you want to give us some background on that?
Well, the big news, I guess, is that Whatcom County Council last night, Tuesday night, voted 4-3 to move forward on a draft to place an initiative on the November ballot for a 0.2% sales tax that would be used to construct a new jail. They haven't made the vote yet on the jail. They just said, yes, move forward, bring us a draft, we'll look at it. I think they're going to look at it on July 11th. So they made the decision. It was a 4-3 vote, which is very contentious. Something similar is going on the city side because the city sent a letter. And I think it was a 4-3 vote at the city to send the letter too, because there are some people that did not really think that should go forward, but to ask the county council for some additional questions so that the city can consider whether it wants to sign on to a jail facility agreement. And if the city signs on to this jail facility agreement, they are, in a sense, giving an endorsement for the jail initiative, that there's no municipal objection to moving forward on this issue from the city standpoint.
And those points that they expressed to the county council were essentially the location of the new jail, the size of the jail, the financial commitments, and also about issues about a booking and holding facility and pretrial inmates and how they're housed. So does this vote, really quickly, does the vote that the county council took, did that go on in spite of the letter?
Yeah, I would say it went on in spite of the letter, but I think the city's letter went on in spite of what the county was going to do too.
Okay.
But I think the really interesting thing that's going to be unfolding here in the next couple of weeks is I don't think that the city's going to get its answers from the county, because I don't think the county council can give the answers that the city asked. And so the city has to decide whether they want to bite the bullet and move forward on this, knowing that their letter was ignored. Because I think this county council's, I don't think they're going to ignore it. That's a harsh word, but they can't answer the questions on there.
And we will get into that more in future weeks, I am quite certain. You've been listening to Cascadia News Now. That was Tim Johnson. You are also joined by host Dave Willingham, and I'm Stephanie Contouris. And our engineer, the fabulous Devlin Sweeney, and brand new uncle. We want to give a shout out to Sprout and Sprout's family. Yay, welcome, Sprout. Our technical director is Dave Willingham, and you have been listening to KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham and KAVZ 102.5 in Deming.